another podcast provided by the CPA Technology Advisor at the intersection of technology and public accounting.
From the intersection of technology and public accounting,
it's technology advice and insight you can trust.
This is Tech2Go.
Tech2Go is the CPA Technology Advisor's monthly podcast program, a fast-paced roundtable discussion with executive editor Greg LaFollett and regular columnist Brent Goodfellow, Dave McClure, and Randy Johnston. These thought leaders tackle current technology issues impacting the tax and accounting profession. Tech2Go is sponsored by ADP.
Hello, Greg LaFollette, Intersection Live, recording episode 18 of the CPA Technology Advisors Intersection Live process, Tech2Go. And I have with me live today at the Tech Plus Conference in Las Vegas from the beautiful Bellagio Hotel, our keynote speaker, number one, Randy Johnston. Hello, Randy.
Good day, Greg.
Thanks for carving out a little bit of time. This was actually the only hour that we all had open at this entire conference, so I'm glad we were able to finally find each other and all be in the same spot.
It's a busy, busy conference. It's been good so far.
It's been fun. Also joining us, a regular contributor and panel member, Brent Goodfellow, no longer from the Northwest today, but down in the desert with us. Brent, welcome.
Good to look at you guys and talk at the same time.
I'm not sure that the first part is right. we have a special guest today. I'm very, very excited to introduce you to David Strom. David was our luncheon keynote speaker, and many of you, I'm sure, have read David. He's a regular contributor to the New York Times. I've read him in the Wall Street Journal and in many periodicals. He's a well-read, very, very interesting speaker and writer and kind of a pundit in the technology world. And we're real lucky to have David. David, thank you so very much for spending some time with us.
Glad to be here.
So, super. We've got a whole bunch of things that we want to talk about, and the first one has been a great big topic, and Randy, you told me a year or two ago, and Brent, so did you, that this idea of virtualization was going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and I watched one of our pre-sessions on Sunday. I watched a room fill up with people coming in early to spend their weekend in a CPE room, in an inside room in a hotel, learning about virtualization in a deep dive. And Brent, I watched a couple of your classes with all sorts of people in there. This whole idea of virtualization is really, really catching on. Let's kind of back up a little bit for the kids in the class like me that might need just a little refresher, and then kind of tell us where we're going. Let's talk about it a little bit. Randy, you spent 4 hours with a whole group of people. We don't have 4 hours, but we've got some time. What is virtualization?
Yeah, there's actually, I think, four classes of virtualization that are pretty popular right now. There's server virtualization. There's storage virtualization that's occurring. There's application virtualization. And then finally, desktop virtualization. And as you look at those four cuts in the industry, I think for many of our listeners, desktop virtualization is actually showing up pretty quickly, or has been on the radar for a while, because we can make those old incompatible applications with Vista run on top of Vista or on the Mac or on the Linux environment by simply packaging all of those historic applications up in a disk file and running it with this virtualization software. There's some economies on the server side, where we can, instead of having 2, 3, 4 and more servers like we do in so many of our operations, to get those down to fewer numbers of servers. There's some performance reasons to do that. There's some reliability reasons to do that. There's some business continuity reasons to do that. There's some energy reasons to do that. Lots of real positive reasons. And as it turns out, those two types of virtualization are driving a whole lot of the marketplace for larger businesses, the storage virtualization kicks into place. And I think over the next little while, having publishers package their application up in such a way that the applications can be delivered as a package that don't really require installation,
sure,
we'll see application virtualization mature. Right. So in any case, it's a complex thing, I think, to try to explain verbally.
Right.
It seems to show so much better because you can build a desktop virtualized machine in a matter of 25 to 45 minutes in a demonstration while talking, and that seems to land home. There's so many business applications. We probably ought to write a list up for the site. In fact, I think I might do that for a future article. Just say, look, here's 16 or 20 ideas to think about that could benefit your business.
Right. David, in your keynote, you had an old quote from Bill Gates that we all chuckled about that said, I'm not sure that I would advise my grandmother to buy one or something like that.
Right.
Would you advise your grandmother to try virtualization, or we're not there yet? Or
no, it's not grandmother ready yet. But certainly the desktop virtualization is the most mature. I mean, you've got three really solid competitors there with VMware, with Citrix. The third one just went out of my head. Where was I going? Microsoft, I guess. Well, it's been a long day. I think what's very interesting, though, is this notion of application virtualization, where we can protect applications from each other.
This is the acquisition that Microsoft did in that Softricity product.
Right.
Okay.
It's basically you don't have to install any software on your computer. You load everything. It's like a streaming video file.
Right. And that's really more something that a publisher would use or a vendor would use to provide something to me as the end user and push it out to me. It's not something that I have to do, right?
Well, you've got to make sure that your apps can be streamed or virtualized. It's not all of them can. I think also, we buy, because the machines are so cheap, we buy one machine for one application and one purpose. And what's really nice about virtualization is that we can protect all these different apps from each other and stepping on each other, and that's really attractive.
Right.
Brent, you and I have been bouncing ideas off each other for 25 years now, and most of your ideas have been pretty crazy. You told me that this Windows thing was going to take off, and of course I do way better than that. And you've been picking out these things for years, and now you're telling me that this virtualization thing is really big, and again, as is usual, you've got the vision, and it's kind of cloudy for me. Help me again understand now for the average practitioner, that 3-5 person shop, guy goes and buys a new laptop. How could he use the concept of virtualization to make his life easier 2 months later or 6 months later? What would your advice be?
Well, if you're talking about a laptop, you're talking about a desktop experience. And I think we have to, at least in my mind, we have to solidify virtualization at the server level. A lot of these small firms have servers that they depend on. Some have invested in Small Business Server, for example. And we have the recent release of Essential Business Server, which is, the splitting of the roles all on a single server with Small Business Server.
Mm-hmm.
At a very attractive price. So we're going to see firms looking at Essential Business Server. And the big question we had when Essential Business Server was initially announced was, is this going to run in a virtualized environment? Because they're talking about four separate servers with the premium edition. The first guy from Microsoft says, well, we're not sure. And we kept at it and kept at it. And finally we found somebody who, was really tuned in to what Microsoft's strategy was. And they said, of course it's going to work in virtualization. We're pushing virtualization, so Essential Business Server is going to run. So theoretically, I think we have to talk about firms, even small firms, that are going to see the benefits of separating the roles such that if one server goes down, not all the services stop. And that's what you've got with Small Business Server. And they can do that in a virtualized environment, eliminating the cost of multiple pieces of hardware.
So again, going back to this small firm or sole practitioner, there's, as David pointed out, there's, you know, there's a Citrix product and there's a Microsoft product and there's a, boy, we certainly heard a lot about this VM thing when EMC spun off VMware, smart guys got rich. That would not include me, but smart guys got rich on that deal. So there's obviously lots of interest there, but does it make a difference which path people go down here at those three providers, or is the concept big enough that the eventual tool is really kind of almost inconsequential?
Well, it's very interesting. I had a fellow, a very technical guy. He wasn't, you know, a firm partner. He was a firm IT manager, if you want to think of it, in a session yesterday. And he was using the fourth virtualization provider, which we haven't mentioned, and that's Zenworks, which is now owned by NetWare.
Yep.
And he was just sold on it, but his one question was, you know, is Microsoft going to support Zenworks in their management software? I have not seen anything that says yes to that, but interestingly enough, they are supporting VMware in their new System Center Virtual Machine Manager in the beta that's out. It's clearly evident in the GUI interface that VMware is going to be supported.
And talking about Novell, there's some actual interesting things going on where they can, you can mix and match your hypervisor with your VM image. So you don't necessarily have to have the same product that creates the VM.
Right.
Manage it.
So I could use VMware, for example, to create a virtual machine, copy it over to a machine on which I'm running the Microsoft virtual machine and launch it. Is that what I'm hearing?
Not right now.
Not quite there.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think what works now is you could load VMware on Windows Server 2008 and manage that with System Center Essentials Virtual Machine Manager. But moving virtual machines from one platform to another, I'm not sure we're ever going to get there, but we might.
Right. Well, that's one, though, that I think might come down the path, actually,
sure.
Because during the past few weeks, Citrix and, you know, let's name some other players, Cisco, Microsoft, and others said, look, we're going to use this standard to communicate between these VMs, and we're going to launch and support these VMs. So all of a sudden we said, well, that's pretty interesting strategy, because if that really becomes the case, then the VM becomes a relocatable unit, and it really doesn't matter what the hypervisor is running underneath. It really doesn't matter whether it's a VMware or a Windows Server 2008 or a Xen or a Citrix or whatever those different hosts might be. So the authoring tools might wind up being a little different here, which is kind of an interesting proposition too, just like we think about Adobe, and I really do like our listeners to think about the Adobe tool as being a model here. Adobe Acrobat writes those files, yet we can read those files with lots of different tools.
Right.
Well, in the VMware environment, VMware Workstation is the authoring tool, and there's a lot of different places that can read those, as it turns out. And VMware's claim to fame a little bit right now is taking a virtual PC image and reading it in straight away and converting it, if you will. But those announcements are about, we're going to use the same tools, the same management pieces. So I'm actually thinking that System Management, you know, Center will actually maybe, you know, consider that just another service on the Xen side, because the open source friendliness isn't quite as bad. Remember this, Bill Gates going away, like you were talking about today, Dave. You know, but basically, you know, with Ray Ozzie in charge here, the culture attitude is a little different.
Right.
At least it feels like it might be. So we'll see if that comes to
They certainly made an effort to reach out to more open source developers over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
So what I hear is we started with this with the idea of virtualization, and it was a very technical thing. It was at the server level. It's now drifting down to the workstation level. Is there a way for this concept to work at what I will call the consumer level, or at maybe the prosumer level? Is that about where we're at right now, that maybe the prosumer can start looking at this, or should start looking at it?
I think it's a little ways away, but you have to take a look at a product like Windows Home Server, which is really built on the foundation of Vista. You know,
right.
So they've got the bits there, and they could easily extend this if there's some sort of an application in the consumer market.
Well, it's a great segue. We want to talk about Windows Home Server. My Windows Home Server has been sitting on a shelf in my home office making a noise like a rock since the day I bought it and put it in. It works absolutely perfectly. It's flawless, and I'm very, very happy with it. And we've talked about this a little bit before, I think for many small firms, I actually talked to a practitioner here, and he and his partner, they're using a Microsoft Home server in their office. It automatically backs up both of their machines. They've used an application, a Jungle Disk application, to back up their home server onto the Amazon S3 cloud. So they've got external backup of all their data, smart, and they're using it. They're using the home server for remote access. Now there's the other. I just got an email the other day from Microsoft inviting me to participate in the quote the open beta, whatever the heck that means, of something that I thought was SP1. It's not SP1. It's PP1. And Brent, you're laughing about that. Explain to us what the heck that is.
Well, Microsoft is not known for its naming of some of their products. I remember the Server Update Service Update, which was originally called Windows Server Update Services, which was the acronym was, trying to think now.
SUSE?
No.
Whatever it was.
It wasn't a good one anyway.
Yeah.
So this PP number one probably should have been called SP1, but it's called PP number
one. For Power Pack, right?
Power Pack.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, so we can joke about what PP number one means. But yeah.
So what did they put in this thing?
There is a number of updates. The most critical one is the correction of the data corruption issues. So if you were editing documents on your home server across the network, the data, there was a good chance that it could be corrupted. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in a lot of cases it was. So the correction to that is in PP1. There's also support for client machines, if you will, desktops that run 64-bit versions of Vista.
Okay.
There is now a backup of the home server shared folders, easier enhanced remote access capabilities. This is Microsoft's list here that I'm working out.
Sure.
We'll be the judge of that. Better energy efficiency. So, again, I think they're updating some of the bits. Windows Server 2008 has a better energy record, 45% in some of the tests that they've done, than Windows Server 2003. So they're probably just using those same bits, would be my guess. Improved performance, and then the last thing is Chinese and Japanese versions.
Oh, right.
So I don't know if they're looking at those mass markets for Windows Home Server, but Obviously they're thinking about that.
Sure. So, David, are you a home server advocate, a fan, a tester? Where are you at in this process?
I've tested an early version, and I certainly could appreciate some of the things that you talked about. I've remained neutral on it because I still think that you do need a fair amount of expertise to get it set up. It's not completely put the disk in, turn it on. There are some companies like HP that are selling pre-configured versions.
Right, which in fairness is what I bought.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think if that's the way you're going to go, that's probably a better way than getting the software.
Right.
Trying to mess with it.
So I think I heard him say it's not a grandmother option quite yet.
Not ready for grandmother.
No, it's not quite there.
Yeah.
Randy, where are you with it? You have one.
I have one here. As well, and it's kind of like you. As I was thinking about your question, it's like I turned it on X period ago, and I don't think I've really even done anything more than throwing another terabyte in it.
Uh-huh. But it's pretty sad when we have to say, oh, it hasn't crashed yet. Yeah, it's Windows, but it hasn't crashed yet.
It's actually hard to conceptualize that, I suppose.
It did what it said it did, and I'm so excited about that that it didn't disappoint me. You're exactly right, David. That's pretty sad.
So, Greg, my brain cramp went away, and I just have to throw this in. Server Update Services, which was the first edition of Server Update Services, when they initially had the update, they were going to call it WUS, Windows Update Services, or WUS.
Right.
And so they had to rename it WSUS.
Okay. That's right. I do remember that. So, this this invite to the PowerPack 1 open beta.
Public beta.
Public beta. Is that something that you would tell the average Joe or the not quite average like me? Should I go ahead and do this?
Well, I think you have to be careful. I mean, Microsoft says with these betas, back up everything before you install the bit. So, mm-hmm. you know, there's certainly a possibility you could lose some of your data. And as for those who don't have the ability to do that and are not technical, it's probably not a good idea to participate.
Sure.
But anyone that feels good about backing up their critical data and wants to test the bits, mm-hmm. They just go to Microsoft Connect, right. sign up, and they can download the bits and test it.
So how long will that period be before Microsoft just starts pushing out the update?
Well, the official word is that they're going to test until the community tells them that their work is acceptable.
Oh, that long?
Could be years.
Right. I mean, I may be retired.
I suspect in reality it'll be later on this year.
Sure. Okay. Well, that's an interesting phenomena. I think the whole idea of the Windows Home Server, and if you think about the amount of technology and the stuff that's in that box that you buy for $700 or $800 and actually take out of box, plug it in, and it works, even 4 or 5 years ago was very, very high technology. And David, in your presentation, you showed computers that we spent $10,000-$15,000 for just a few years ago that now we would laugh at. We wouldn't buy a cell phone that was that underpowered.
Right.
So
I love my home server. I've used it in a number of occasions, needing to log on to a machine at home.
Right.
But I've used it for other things as well, publishing photos to family around the country.
Yes, so many people don't even have their photos or their music libraries. They don't even have any clue that they're not backed up and they're just hanging out there.
That's right.
Yep.
That's a lot of data.
Interesting stuff. Well, let's move on before we go much farther. I want to spend just a second and again thank our friends at ADP for sponsoring Tech2Go. We appreciate those guys and would encourage you, if you're practicing public accounting and you've got clients that actually pay people, and I suspect that we all do, if you're looking at those payroll services, give these guys at least give them a thought. They've got pretty darn good products. There are other companies that have good products, but these guys have good products and they support Tech2Go. And we think the combination of both of those things deserves that they get an extra special look. So go over and take a look at them. If you're already doing business with them, just tell the salesperson the only reason you're doing business with them is because they support Tech2Go, and we'll appreciate that a lot. They do some pretty good stuff on their website. As I pointed out before, they've got a section they call the Accountant Focus. It's kind of a newsletter for accountants, and I go over there and look at it every once in a while because I'm pretty convinced that they can't possibly come up with anything that would be new in payroll. And there's always something new, always something kind of interesting, and it fascinates me that they're able to do that for something that's as exciting as public accounting and payroll, but they manage to find things that are interesting. So I'd encourage you to go over and take a look at that. I wanted to talk for a second. We had one of Randy's partners, Dr. Bob Spencer, did a very popular session for us here at Tech Plus yesterday, a session called Inspector Gadget, where it went through a whole series of different toys and things, and as he, one of the things that he introduced was the Magic Jack, and as he was talking about it, he actually demonstrated it live, and he said, "Does anybody here use the Magic Jack?" I quickly pulled mine out of my briefcase and held it up and said, "I use mine, and I kind of like this thing. It's kind of interesting." David Strom mentioned to me that he'd looked at it, and it's not probably the best product I've ever seen, but it's interesting in what it does and how it works. David, can you kind of summarize for me what this thing is?
Well, when you buy it, it looks like you're buying a box of spare parts, I mean, it's just the damnedest thing. You get a USB dongle thingy, you get a headset and earphone thingy, and you get some software that you put on your Windows machine, and basically it allows you to make IP voice calls from your laptop without having anything other than an internet connection.
It's actually pretty interesting. I saw it at CES, and I didn't know that it shipped with all that stuff, because I saw it at CES, and they were handing them out like M&Ms. So I had a half dozen of them that they dumped into my bag, and I handed them out to my friends and kept the last one, and I've been using the last one. And so when I plugged it in, it went to the internet and downloaded the software, and I didn't get my headset, but then again, I didn't pay for the right device. You plug this thing in, it actually assigns you a telephone number if you chose to use it for incoming calls, which I think is almost a solution in search of a problem, at least in my world. But I was, as an example, we were talking about this a little earlier, as many of you know, I spent the month of April in Brazil, and I used the Magic Jack when I plugged it into my laptop and made a telephone call to my wife in the U.S., I was actually calling from a U.S. number to a U.S. number, so there was no charge. It was not an international call, because the internet looks at that device and says, oh, you're in this case, I have a Michigan number, because Magic Jack doesn't know about South Dakota. So it thinks I'm making a call from Michigan to South Dakota, thereby free. If I were using Skype is IP location-based, and it would say, oh, you're in Brazil calling the U.S., I'm going to charge you for an international call. Now, interestingly enough, if I were at my machine sitting in a hotel room in São Paulo and I wanted to call next door, that would be an international call, because I was calling, in that case, from the U.S. to Brazil.
With all of these IP phone services, you have to like spend a minute and think it through, like what you're going to do and what scenario is going to work for you, and whether if you're going to be on a wired or a wireless network, and whether you want to have cell phone coverage or not, and if the hotel is going to charge you for internet access or not. I mean, there's a lot of things. You almost need to have an IRS CPA to figure all this out, because it's very complicated. While it's true that Skype will charge you, the cost of those international calls is pennies a minute.
Exactly.
So you're just being a real cheapskate here. But the Magic Jack, for what's really great about it is it's just one. You pay it one time. There's no per use
exactly
of anything that you're doing with it. Right. So unlike the other voice over IP services.
Right. And David, just so you know, everybody in the room is laughing because you called me a cheapskate, and cheapskate and CPA is
right.
redundant.
Right. I understand.
So you don't need
right.
to go there.
Okay. I'm just trying to have a little, humor.
It's genetic.
Wake everybody
they're
up.
They're synonyms of each other.
Right. Exactly. So Brent, now you're a soft phone guy, uh-huh. and you're way into internet telephony and things. Mm-hmm. What do you see? And not necessarily the Magic Jack, but this whole thing. What do you do?
Well, I don't travel a lot internationally, so that is not an issue.
Not
for
an
me,
issue. Okay.
But I travel domestically a lot,
right.
And I simply use my cell phone to connect to my switch in Portland, and then I can go anywhere from there, and that's the way I do it.
Right.
We have a hybrid phone system that supports both TDM and VoIP, and firms are thinking about moving, and I know a lot of them are. You know, my recommendation is to look for a system that is hybrid like that, so they can support their legacy equipment while they slowly move into the VoIP world.
Okay. Now, Randy, you guys at the K2 organization have just moved recently to a full VoIP system, and as a matter of fact, we talked about that last time we recorded Tech2Go, because I thought you were in Louisiana when you called in, and you were actually in Kansas, and you were actually gone for a while because of a little technology blip and things. Do you think this internet telephony, not VoIP particularly, but this kind of portable VoIP. Is this something that is ready for prime time?
Well, it may not be ready for the non-technical users, using the mother-grandmother typology here. It's not trivial, but like the Magic Jack, going back to that one that we've talked about, pretty much all of the players on our K2 team carry one of those. Actually, I've got my daughter using one of those because she wanted a New York number, being in the theater business. That makes good sense. It turns out my Magic Jack number is a New York number also.
Oh, did you get a 212?
So I actually have a very nice New York number.
Good for you.
And so we actually use it along those lines, which is very, very convenient. And again, $69 for unlimited calls for 3 years is pretty affordable. Quality seems to hold pretty well.
If you're on a wired connection, especially.
A wired connection.
Wireless is still a little dicey, yeah.
No, wireless is not good. You're absolutely right. But it's interesting that it presents the line as a wired line. Mm-hmm. So we've actually used some Magic Jacks back-ending traditional old KSU systems.
Uh-huh.
So where you might have a few lines into a small business at your local carrier rates of, $35 to $60 a line, and maybe you have two or three lines, we can put in a couple of Magic Jacks for $69 for a couple of years and have unlimited long distance on two analog presented lines that plug into a KSU. Well, trying to be cheapskate on that actually is a pretty darn good business application. On the other hand, indeed, both my K2 businesses and my NMGI business are both voice over IP phone systems at this point. Product that we've used inside our K2 business is an Intertel system. Seems to be working quite well. I think it's a nice entry-level system. In my NMGI business, have a little more, I'll say, flexibility, variability in the way we use the phone system there. But one of our variants, for example, is we have a lot of guys carrying PDA class units with data services. So right now we're doing a lot of soft phones on the PDA through the data side. So we're connecting as a SIP phone call, so we're not using cell phone minutes to make cellular calls. So in effect, I've got guys on data plans here that are basically have unlimited data, and we're not burning any cell phone minutes for most of our calls now. So that's kind of an interesting
twist. Of course, those unlimited data cell phone plans are going to go the way of the dodo pretty soon.
Yeah,
you're already seeing some backpedaling. I think it's from AT&T.
Yeah.
Well, and all of the that's true not only at the cell phone level, but just at the internet connection level on the consumer side. We're very quickly finding out that the idea of an unlimited data plan is you can have all you want. But this is all you can have for that. Mm-hmm. Comcast is trying to figure out how to cap people, and there's lots of problems mm-hmm. in there. Because mm-hmm. frankly, there is no such thing as unlimited. That's insane.
Well, everything costs. But if you look at the revenue model for the phone companies over the years, they've been making 1,000% markups on long distance phone calls, for example. And so this is just the result of that. Over time, they've been overcharging. And now they're finding that people are expecting much lower rates that they're having a hard time providing.
Exactly. I wrote a column a couple of years ago that I titled "Too Cheap to Measure," and predicted that all of the cell phone people would soon get to the point where, because as you looked at that cell phone industry, what you found was that they're actually spending as much money tracking time, billing time, and accounting for time and reporting time is that we're actually delivering the service. And it just doesn't make any sense. And, finally, we've driven all of that out of it, and they don't even bother. It's just too cheap to measure. You just kind of give up on it. Let's change gears here. There are a couple of other topics I want to get to, and we, as usual, we are time constrained. I do want to point out for all of you that are listening, as we always do, we prepare a set of show notes, so all of the websites and product names and things that we've been talking about will be in the show notes at the CPA Technology Advisor or CPA Tech Advisor, CPATA is the cheap and easy way to get there. And just click in, look at the podcast, and find this one. And this is episode 18, and you'll find all of the different things that we were talking about and hyperlinks to them makes life a lot easier. We always record live on TalkShoe. This particular month, we're not recording on TalkShoe because we're all live and in the same room, and it's really kind of fun to do this. So we're all together, but we will be together. And people are sticking their tongues out at me. Next month, on July 16th, on Wednesday, July 16th, 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, we will record Tech2Go episode 19 on TalkShoe. So if you're interested in joining us, you can always feel welcome to come over and join us. If you've got a question, raise your electronic hand, and we'll pull you in and visit with you. And that's always fun to do. So we'd look forward to the company. If you want to call in when you do dial in to TalkShoe on July 16th, if you want to call on your brand new iPhone, I think you can do that because I think it's on sale. July 16th. Wasn't that the date?
11th.
Was it the 11th?
Yeah, 11th.
Okay, well, that gives you a couple of days. You stand in line for a few days, I suppose. I don't know. Are you going to go stand in line, Dave?
I may actually end up buying it. My daughter got an iPhone yesterday, so she's showing me up. I can't have my daughter have more recent technology than I have.
So
it's embarrassing as a technology consultant.
Well, we might just say it's time to get over it.
Yeah. Really. I know.
It's hard to keep up with all the toys. The people who own them love them, and what do? They cut the price, right?
They cut the price. They went to 3G so that you actually have a decent bandwidth for
the Safari web browser.
For the browsing, right. So it's still 8 or 16 gigs of memory. So.
Right.
Isn't it the version that's also going to support Exchange so to attract the corporate customers?
Exactly. Yeah. Full support of Exchange. So we're going to kind of probably quit saying it's not a business device if it has native support for Exchange. I mean, what else does it take to be a business device?
Well, it's not going to run Windows Mobile, obviously. So, you know, if that's
is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Windows Mobile is kind of a POS, in my opinion. But you know,
it's not point of sale.
For someone that's used Windows Mobile, you know, for a long time, they might actually like to read Word documents on that 2-inch screen. That mm-hmm. for me, I think it's a little bit small. But this is a huge deal. Because now Apple is going after kind of a sacred cow at Microsoft. And they've kind of supported Exchange in the past, but only if Exchange is configured to accept IMAP or
right.
POP3 connections.
Right.
And most corporate environments are not willing to do that.
Exactly.
So this is a pretty big deal, and uh-huh. it'll be interesting to see how it all pans out.
Of course, using the words Apple and enterprise corporate support in the same sentence, mm-hmm. we've all been down that road before,
right? They're known as the consumer company, yeah.
And they just don't understand how to approach companies.
That's right.
Well, I know I still see, even at Tech Plus, I still see an amazing number of people carrying dumb phones who haven't moved to smartphones. And I mean, I don't understand that. Somebody's going to pull out a dumb phone, sure as heck.
I think this is a pretty damn good phone. It's my Motorola Razr.
Pretty good phone. It's the old Razr. Gartner came out with some interesting stuff the other day. Apple, they announced that Apple sold 1.73 million iPhones in the first 3 months of the year. 5.3% share of the worldwide market. You know, there's 7.3 million smartphones in the U.S., not iPhones, but smartphones in the U.S. These numbers are just absolutely phenomenal. They're almost to the point where one out of every two cell phones so far in 2008 worldwide has been a smartphone. And of course, the blur between what's a smartphone and what's not a smartphone is starting to get a little it's a little fuzzy. What's it take, Randy, to be a smartphone, in your opinion?
I'm a pretty simple guy on this. I really want it to do more than be a phone, okay. And that typically will be give me calendar, give me email, messaging. Usually I'm going to go after some sort of browser capability.
Right. And context.
Right. And maybe be able to load additional applications.
Right. I think that's the big one. It's got to have, in my opinion, third-party apps.
It's got to sync the information that Randy was talking about because, you know, I have an iPod Touch and I can put contacts on there and I can put calendar on there, but it doesn't sync with my mail server.
It syncs, and as soon as you plug it into your laptop, it'll sync.
Well, I sync over the air to my Exchange server.
Exactly, as do I.
Yeah.
So. Does it take, I think it takes a QWERTY keyboard to be a smartphone, but boy, I watch people who.
Well, if you're under 20, you don't need. You know, that's not a problem.
Okay, that's where I was.
I found the keyboard on the iPod Touch a little bit hard to get used to, but
I think it's terrible.
But once I'm getting better at it, I guess. I don't know that it's any less difficult than a QWERTY keyboard for me, but again, everyone's experience is going to be different.
Yeah, and I'll have to admit, you know, we talked about carpal thumb 4 years ago.
Right.
So I actually, on the thumb boards, I can run them fairly quickly, but I don't hold up too well on that. But you're absolutely right. I was watching some of the younger attendees here at Tech, and they're listening, and they're also multitasking, doing text messaging and email, and they're going at very, very high speeds on the products they're carrying, which is
cool. And that's all T9. That's not real keyboard.
No?
Yep.
All.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, stuck quick. I assume many people have read Mark Perkle's work where he talks about the digital immigrant, digital native, and actually talks about the way that kids who grew up in a completely digital world, their brain actually physically works differently, and they're wired to multitask. When those of us who grew up in the analog world, you're taught the way you study is sit in your room very quietly and with a highlighter and things like that. Our brains work the way we were trained to work, and so physically we're one off, and they're multitaskers. Kind of interesting.
Yeah, and the other thing I think we have to be sure and note here is the other carriers aren't going to sit down for this, you know, with AT&T. There's going to be iPhone lookalikes out there from Samsung and Nokia and other carriers that are going to do some of the same kinds of things and maybe even run Windows Mobile. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, Nokia has 47% of the worldwide cell phone market, and they will not go quietly. They've done pretty well up till then, and you know the RIM guys.
I think RIM is really the one who's going to be worried. How long will it take RIM to get to million plus users? Probably about 5 years.
A long, long time.
Yeah.
So we'll stay tuned for the iPhone 2, and if you go get one, let us know how you're doing with it, and we'll come back and visit that from time to time.
Well, maybe a little closing comment, and that is the Economist had some interesting reporting in this area in the March-April timeframe because they were basically talking about the convergence of internet, cell phone technology, a couple of three salient points I think they had. First, there were about 3.3 billion phones in use in the worldwide market, and they were forecasting that within 2 years there'd be 4 billion. That's a pretty...
Who's left?
Yeah, so you start thinking about it from that perspective. And then, you know, as you take it on down, it's the convergence of the devices, and then they were also talking about the mobility of the workers and the, you know, mobile office type of approaches and the way the campuses were built and so forth. So I think the cell phones are going to become well beyond cell phones. And we started our time together today talking about, you know, virtual machines, but the Chinese Olympics here in the summer are going to be running reporters with virtual machines on cell phones.
Exactly.
Running Linux as their operating system. And, you know, when you think about that large-scale test and what's happening in that market, it'd be pretty interesting to have a cell phone computer.
Right. And just, I mean, as a final close in that, you know, Gates has been making... You know, you had a tribute today, Dave, to Bill Gates of sorts. He's been talking about one of the things that they want to get rid of completely is the whole concept of telephone numbers, and you know that maybe we're gonna come up with some identifying thing for humans as they're born, and then that's what it is, and you don't need telephone numbers or email addresses or whatever that is. Lots of stuff there. Let's spend our last few minutes together talking about about social networking. I just did a class here at Tech. Had people standing in the back, kind of wall to wall folk, and we talked about blogging and podcasting and social networking. And a lot of accountants my age, that would be old, kind of shaking their head and saying, I just don't get this Facebook, LinkedIn stuff. Dave, you talked about this in your presentation. There's way too many of them. They don't talk to each other. It's a mess. But on the other hand, it's the way that people are, especially that 25 and under group, it's the way they stay in touch. Is this something that is meaningful for accountants today, or is it just something to watch as they come in the future?
This is definitely grandma-ready technology.
Okay.
And in spite of the fact that the 20-somethings have claimed it as their, you know, main application, I mean, my daughter, I think she's on Facebook 20 hours a day. You know, and it documents everything. She's the post-IM generation. IM is not as important to her now as Facebook. But I do think that accountants and the older folks need to get on board with this technology, need to use it as a way to start conversations with your customers, your business partners, your clients, your suppliers, because it's really a great way to interact and have a two-way kind of exchange of information, and also widen your degree of sphere of influence and of your social circle, not necessarily just connecting up friends and saying, hey, I'm in Vegas, want to go out to dinner with me tonight, which some people do very successfully in that kind of ad hoc meeting area, but just to present business problems that groups of people can work on together.
So I'm in process, as we're speaking, of updating my Facebook status to say that we're recording Tech2Go live right now, and I'll blast that out in about 2 seconds, and away we go, because I use Facebook. I don't have the courage to use Twitter. I have a Twitter account. It feeds my blog, but somehow the idea of saying, you know, I had roast beef for lunch is just a little too much for me. I can't quite get there. I heard you say something like that in your keynote.
But I think what all these, I mean, you really have to be very ego involved and to do some of these things initially. But there are some people that are using Twitter to generate new business opportunities. LinkedIn, I use LinkedIn all the time to identify people that I want to interview for my articles. I put out a query there, and within a matter of minutes, I get some very useful comments from people back saying, you know, I'm an expert in this area, or I can help you. Excuse me. So I think they have a lot of value. I think the problem is that there are just so many damn many of them.
Right.
And you just
get
overwhelmed, and just pick one or two to just focus on.
So it's usually time consuming too.
Oh yeah.
Can be very addictive. On the other hand, I mean, I use Facebook. I check it occasionally, and it makes me feel very connected to a lot of people, because I look down my list and I see, you know, different people are doing different things. I don't have to communicate with them, but I see what they're doing, and it makes me feel connected, and I have a relationship that's different. Now, I don't know what the heck that has to do with public accounting, but perhaps I have a group in my Facebook site or over on, you know, that says clients. And I can kind of look and see maybe what they're doing and feel a little bit more connected that way. Randy, you use these things?
You know, let's face it, it's a relationship business.
Yep.
And what we're really talking about is a new or an additional way to relate. And, you know, I am just a very, very casual user of most of these items, simply because again, it's the time consumption, and I don't want to have something that's fairly dead, which is where most of that would be. You know, again, I go back, though, to just watching what other associates, what the children are doing and so forth, and the Twitters and the Facebooks and all of those different elements. It's pretty clear that there's a lot of traffic there, and it's been interesting watching deals put together here as of late that were completely done electronically, and most of those, for example, were Facebook deals. Mm-hmm. So
It's interesting, in the telephony class that I did yesterday, the vast majority of those that were there said they wouldn't even consider allowing their clients to even talk to an auto attendant. And so it's going to be a huge, you know, leap for them to go to some sort of an electronic relationship, right, when they can't even get to the point where they have to live answer every call, you know.
Except when those clients start saying, like me, I don't want to talk to the receptionist. I want DID. Because it's not that I hate people, but I don't want to have a conversation with a receptionist. You know, she goes, "Oh, hi, how are you?" I said, "Fine, how are you? How's the kids?" Because, I mean, while she's a nice gal, I don't care about the kids. I just want to talk to the person, and we're all time constrained. Right. So when people start understanding that that's an issue, I think that'll change.
Yeah, it's amazing, and that's the point I made, but it's the mindset of the profession right now.
Right.
I've seen it for years.
As we've said for many, many times, the old joke about how many CPAs does it take to change a light bulb? And David, I don't know if you know the answer to that. The answer
I'll
is...
I'll play the straight man. Yeah, no, Greg. How many?
The answer is change? Oh, no. We're CPAs. There will be no change. Listen, we are, as usual, we've burned up our time together. David, I appreciate very much your spending time with us. We enjoyed having you a lot. This has been episode 18 of Tech2Go Intersection Live, the podcast series for the CPA Technology Advisor. I'm Greg LaFollette. Thank you to our guest, David Strom.
Thank you.
Thank you, Randy, for your time again today.
Pleased to be with you all.
Brent, thanks again very much for your time. I look forward to seeing, with air quotes, all of you on Wednesday, July 16th, 2 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time. This is Tech2Go, episode 18. That's it. Goodbye.
That wraps up this edition of Tech2Go. Join the team around the table again next month for more technology advice and insight you can trust. This has been a podcast provided by the CPA Technology Advisor at the intersection of technology and public accounting.